But let's now adopt Western hypocrisy and cynicism and keep to the operative definition of terror, which is the same as the official definition, but with the Nuremberg exception. Admissible terror is your terror. Ours is exempt. Even with this constraint, terror is a major problem, undoubtedly, and to mitigate or terminate the threat should be a high priority. Regrettably, it is not. The invasion of Iraq is perhaps the most glaring example of the low priority assigned by U.S. and British leaders to the threat of terror. They had been advised by their own intelligence agencies and others that the invasion was likely to increase the threat of terror, and indeed it did, as the same intelligence agencies confirm. To take just one of many illustrations, last May, the CIA reported that Iraq has become a magnet for Islamic militants, similar to Soviet-occupied Afghanistan two decades ago and Bosnia in the 1990s. The CIA concluded that Iraq may prove to be an even more effective training ground for Islamic extremists than Afghanistan was in al-Qaeda's early years because it is serving as a real-world laboratory for urban combat. Shortly after the London bombing last July, Chatham House released a study concluding, in their words, there is no doubt that the invasion of Iraq has given a boost to the al-Qaeda network in propaganda, recruitment, and fundraising while providing an ideal training ground for terrorists and leaves the UK, the United Kingdom, at particular risk because it is the closest ally of the United States and is a pillion passenger of American policy in Iraq and Afghanistan, riding behind the driver of the motorcycle. And in fact, terrorist crimes sharply escalated in the following year, approximately tripled. Well, there's extensive supporting evidence to show that, as anticipated, the invasion increased the risk of terror and nuclear proliferation. None of that shows that planners prefer these consequences, of course. Rather, they're not of much concern in comparison with much higher priorities, priorities that are obscure only to those who prefer what human rights researchers sometimes call intentional ignorance, a widely distributed plague among the educated. Once again, we find very easily a way to reduce the threat of terror. Stop acting in ways that predictably enhance the threat. Well, though enhancement of the threat of terror and proliferation was anticipated in the invasion of Iraq, the invasion actually did so even in unanticipated ways. It's common to say that no weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq after an exhaustive search. However, that's not quite accurate. There were stores of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, namely those that were produced in the 1980s, thanks to aid provided by the United States and Britain, along with others. These sites had been secured by UN inspectors who were, in fact, dismantling the weapons, but the inspectors were dismissed by the invaders, and the sites were left unguarded. The inspectors, nevertheless, continued to carry out their work with satellite imagery. They discovered sophisticated, massive looting of these installations in over 100 sites. That includes weapons, includes equipment for producing solid and liquid propellant missiles, biotoxins, and other materials usable for chemical and biological weapons, and also high-precision equipment capable of making parts for nuclear and chemical weapons and missiles. A Jordanian journalist who was monitoring the Jordanian-Iraqi border found that after the U.S.-UK forces took over, radioactive materials were detected in one out of every eight trucks crossing to Jordan, destination unknown, and we'd rather not guess. Well, the ironies are almost inescapable, inexpressible. The official justification for the U.S.-UK invasion was to prevent the use of weapons of mass destruction that did not exist. The invasion provided the terrorists who had been mobilized by the U.S. and its allies with the means to develop weapons of mass destruction, namely equipment that they had provided to Saddam Hussein, caring nothing about the terrible crimes that were later invoked to whip up support for the invasion. It's as if Iran were now making nuclear weapons using fissionable material provided by the U.S. To Iran under the Shah, which may indeed be happening. All of these would be headlines in boldface in every newspaper in a free country in the world that's concerned with the truth of the important truths. You can judge how many times you've read it. Turning to another domain, the U.S. Treasury Department has a bureau that's assigned the task of investigating suspicious financial transfers. It's a central component of the war on terror. In April 2004, the Bureau gave its regular report to Congress, and it informed Congress that of its 120 employees, four were assigned to tracking the finances of Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, while six times that many were occupied with enforcing the embargo against Cuba. Tells you something else about priorities. This goes way back. From 1990 to 2003, there were 93 terrorism-related investigations with $9,000 in fines and 11,000 Cuba-related investigations with $8 million in fines. The revelations, of course, received the silent treatment in the U.S. media and elsewhere as well, to my knowledge. Well, why should the Treasury Department devote vastly more energy to strangling Cuba than to the war on terror? Well, the basic reasons were explained in internal documents of the Kennedy-Johnson years. State Department planners warned that, in their words, the very existence of the Castro regime is successful defiance of U.S. policies going back 150 years to the Monroe Doctrine. Notice, not Russians, but intolerable defiance of the master of the hemisphere, much like Iran's crime of successful defiance in 1979. Punishment of the population of Cuba was regarded as fully legitimate, so we also learn from internal documents. The Eisenhower State Department decided that, in their words, the Cuban people are responsible for the regime, so therefore the United States has the right to cause them to suffer by economic strangulation, later escalated to direct and very serious terror by Kennedy. Eisenhower and Kennedy agreed that the embargo would hasten Fidel Castro's departure as a result of what they called rising discomfort among hungry Cubans. But notice that all of that fits to a T, the definition of terror, quite apart from the direct terrorist acts, which were serious. And so it continued. When Cuba was in dire straits after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Washington intensified the punishment of the people of Cuba at the initiative of liberal Democrats. The author of the 1992 resolution to tighten the blockade proclaimed that, "My objective is to wreak havoc in Cuba." That's New Jersey liberal Democrat Robert Torricelli. And all of that continues to the present moment, putting the war on terror very deep in the shadows, because it's much less important than this. If reducing the threat of terror were a high priority for Washington or London, there would be ways to proceed, even apart from the unmentionable idea of withdrawing participation. The first step, plainly, is to try to understand its roots. With regard to Islamic terror, there's a broad consensus among intelligence agencies and researchers. They identify two categories. On the one hand are the jihadis, organized by the U.S. and its allies in the 1980s. They regard themselves as a vanguard. It's one category. The other category is their audience, which may reject terror, but nevertheless regard the cause of the jihadis as just. So a serious counter-terror campaign would therefore begin by considering the grievances and, where appropriate, addressing them, as should be done with or without the threat of terror. Some experience in Ireland about this. There's broad agreement among specialists that al-Qaeda-style terror, I'm quoting, is today less a product of Islamic fundamentalism than a simple strategic goal to compel the United States and its Western allies to withdraw combat forces from the Arabian Peninsula and other Muslim countries. That's Robert Pape, who's the academic scholar who's done the major studies of suicide bombers. Serious analysts have pointed out that bin Laden's words and deeds correlate closely, and history reveals the same. The jihadis, who were organized by the Reagan administration and its allies, ended their Afghan-based terror inside Russia after the Russians withdrew from Afghanistan, though they continue it from occupied Muslim Chechnya, which is the scene of horrifying Russian crimes back to the 19th century. Osama himself turned against the United States in 1991 because he took it to be occupying the holiest Arab land. That was later acknowledged by the Pentagon as a reason for shifting U.S. bases from Saudi Arabia to Iraq. Additionally, Osama was angered by the rejection of his offer to join the attack against Saddam. The most extensive scholarly inquiry into the jihadi phenomenon by the American scholar Fawaz Girgis concludes that after 9/11, I'm quoting him, the dominant response to al-Qaeda in the Muslim world was very hostile, specifically among the jihadis, who regarded it as an extremely dangerous extremist fringe. Instead of recognizing that opposition to al-Qaeda, instead of recognizing that the existence of the opposition and the fact that it offered Washington the most effective way to drive a nail into its coffin by finding intelligent means to nourish and support the internal forces that were opposed to militant ideologies like the bin Laden network, the Bush administration did exactly what bin Laden hoped it would do, resort to violence, particularly in the invasion of Iraq. Investigations by Israeli and Saudi intelligence, which are supported by U.S. Strategic Studies Institutes, conclude that foreign fighters in Iraq, which are maybe 5 to 10% of the insurgents, were mobilized by the invasion and furthermore had no previous record of association with terrorist groups. The achievements of the Bush administration planners and its pillion rider, their achievements in inspiring Islamic radicalism and terror and in joining Osama in creating a clash of civilizations are quite impressive. The senior CIA analyst responsible for tracking Osama bin Laden from 1996, Michael Scheuer, writes that U.S. forces and policies are completing the radicalization of the Islamic world, something Osama bin Laden has been trying to do with substantial but incomplete success since the early 1990s. As a result, Scheuer adds, it is fair to conclude that the United States of America remains bin Laden's only indispensable ally. The grievances that the jihadis appeal to as a mobilizing technique, those are very real. A Pentagon advisory board panel just a few months ago concluded that Muslims do not hate our freedom, but rather they hate our policies. And they added that when American public diplomacy talks about bringing democracy to Islamic societies, this is seen as no more than self-serving hypocrisy. Those conclusions go back many years. If we choose not to know them, it's because of intentional ignorance. They've been public for a long time. President Eisenhower in 1958 puzzled about what he called the campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world, not by the governments, but by the people who are on Nasser's side, supporting independent secular nationalism, which the U.S. opposed. It was supporting fundamentalist extremism. The reason for the campaign of hatred was explained by the National Security Council, the highest planning organization. Here are their words. In the eyes of the majority of Arabs, the United States appears to be opposed to the realization of the goals of Arab nationalism. They believe that the United States is seeking to protect its interest in Near East oil by supporting the status quo and opposing political or economic progress. Furthermore, they say, the perception is understandable. Our economic and cultural interests in the area have led, not unnaturally, to close U.S. relations with elements in the Arab world whose primary interest lies in the maintenance of relations with the West and the status quo in their countries, blocking democracy and development. They didn't go on to point out that this is the most extreme fundamentalist fanatics in the world and also some of the most brutal and vicious regimes. That's 1958. Right after 9/11, the Wall Street Journal carried out a survey of the opinions of what they called moneyed Muslims. That's immediately after 9/11. They surveyed bankers, professionals, businessmen, all committed to official so-called Western values and embedded in the neoliberal globalization project. They, too, were dismayed by Washington's support for harsh authoritarian states and the barriers Washington erects against development and democracy by propping up oppressive regimes. That goes on to the present moment. They, however, had new grievances beyond those reported by the National Security Council in 1958, primarily Washington's sanctions regime in Iraq, U.S.-British sanctions regime, and support for didn't mean much in the West, but slaughtering hundreds of thousands of people, devastating the society, strengthening Saddam, probably preventing him from being overthrown. Now, that actually meant something among the backward people of the Arab world. That was one. And the other was support for Israel's military occupation and takeover of the occupied territories. There was no survey carried out of the great mass of poor and suffering people, but it's likely that their sentiments are more intense, coupled with bitter resentment of the Western-oriented elites and the corrupt and brutal rulers backed by Western power who ensure that the enormous wealth of the region flows to the West, apart from enriching themselves. And the Iraq invasion only intensified these feelings further, much as anticipated, also contributing materially to the increase in the threat and reality of nuclear proliferation and international terrorism. Well, there are ways to deal constructively with the threat of terror, though not preferred by bin Laden's indispensable ally, or by those who want to avoid the real world by striking heroic poses about Islamo-fascism, or those who simply claim that no proposal has been made when there are quite straightforward proposals that they do not like. The constructive ways begin with an honest look in the mirror, never an easy task, always a necessary one.